The theater. The theater. Bring out Louis.
Theater. Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater. Theater.
Dudes.
Howdy
dudes.
Do, y'all.
Dudes.
How do. Dudes.
I'm
How
trying do. Not to use dudes so much.
Oh, I love dudes.
I do too, but
it's gender neutral. It is. It's absolutely gender neutral.
That's why
yeah,
I like
I don't
y'all.
Know. I got talked to about it, so I'm using y'all
wrong.
And... I'm using y'all and folks I'm as
y'all
much as possible.
Is a, I just it. Like y'all. It's campy sounding, it's cute sounding, and it includes everybody.
Yeah,
but
I've
y'all
used
are
my whole
dudes.
Life. Yeah, y'all my dudes. because if we haven't learned anything from Good Burger, I'm a dude, he's a dude,
we're
she's
all dudes.
A dude, because
we're
all
dudes. Right.
Okay. They're all dudes, too.
Good Burger philosophy.
Yes, there we go.
Good Some Burger lessons. Philosophy. Yep.
Yeah,
now you
absolutely.
Know. Now you
yeah.
know. Good Burger 2 coming out on Paramount Plus this year.
Yeah, can't wait.
I feel like
can't
we
wait.
Should watch that at some point
we
for
probably
something.
Should.
I've never
we should
seen
do both
it before.
Of them. You've never
I
seen
just
Good
know
Burger?
The all, I know the all that sketch.
Oh,
like,
sure.
I've seen that a billion. I was
sure.
the perfect age during
yes,
all
sure,
that.
Sure,
so.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, well, sure. we... okay, well, we don't need to discuss the dude thing anymore, but I've always seen it as it's just everyone's a dude. Because really what it is it's an infected hair on an elephant's butt, and anybody can do that. Anybody can be that.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah.
Sure you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Scott, you said you wanted to say what's up.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a big shout out and thanks to, first of all, to both of you for coming out and supporting the TGNC Festival, Transgender Nonconforming Reading Festival that Sacred Fools did in conjunction with Rainbow Entertainment and their Act Now acting class, which is a class that's 100% run and for trans and non-binary students, as well as the Queer 26, which is an amazing organization, which basically helps with training of in multimedia. For trans, non-binary, and queer folks. And it was a four-day marathon craziness, and it was a little bit magical, and I stand a little humbled and honored to have been you know, part of it. I mean, I was just a part that literally did spreadsheets and opened up the doors. But to watch a community of people who don't normally get to be a community of people telling their own stories and... Jace Allen, who's from Rainbow Entertainment, I think put it best. He's like, it was a chance for them to play their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their cousins, an opportunity that the industry and quite frankly, society doesn't always allow them to do. So just thanks to everybody who came out and supported and we did it all for, you know, Sacred Fools didn't take a cent of it. And it was just a cool thing, and we hope that it's the first, that it was just the inaugural festival, and that we'll be doing it again next year. But it was really affecting to me, and I laughed and I cried all weekend at some amazing stories. So thanks to everybody.
Yeah, CJ and I got to see a few of them. I got to see a couple of blocks. CJ, I think, saw more. But it was a great weekend, especially for a first go at. Like, I'm excited to see how it evolves.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure.
So are we.
Yeah.
A lot of lessons learned about how to put together a festival, but we did it.
Just had a lot of, it was just a good time. Met some new folks that I wouldn't have otherwise met. And it was just good feels all over the place and really, really enjoyed it. And it was almost like a mini Fringe, just kind of like being at the theater for lots of hours in one weekend. It was great.
Yep. Cool.
Agreed.
Thank you. Just
for sure. We were doing some theater. We were watching some theater. We were watching a bunch of amazing people make theater. Because what else are we here to do but theater?
Indeed.
Welcome.
Nice.
The theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers. By the from the LA theater. I fucked myself up. I'm Jay Bailey Bertram.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
Yes, and each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. This week is a Scott's pick. Scott, what'd you choose and why?
Well, I was really trying to press buttons initially, because I know CJ hasn't seen a lot of David Lynch.
None, actually.
But at the end of, but at the end of the episode, you suggested Elephant Man, although we were both wrong. The movie is not based on the play.
That's true. That's
it's its own thing.
It came out within 3 years of each other, so I assumed, but I was wrong.
Right, yeah. The play actually tried to sue the movie for the use of the title. Long story. Anyway.
Yeah.
I'm really glad we did. It's a movie I revisit every few years. I saw it when I was way too young, and it affected me in a very profound way. It still shakes me up. It shook me up to rewatch it for this. But it also has a few moments when I sort of rediscovered it was in college, senior year, and we were really talking a lot about acting choices and how those are connected to character development, all that good stuff. And there's one moment in particular in this film, and we'll talk about it later, that just floors me. I think it's just a brilliant, elegant acting choice, and it really affected me. And it's loaded with theater veterans, like legendary grandmaster theater veterans in secondary and tertiary roles.
So it was just
exciting to revisit it and share it with everybody.
For sure. Siege, so you had not seen this movie before?
No, but I am surrounded by so many people that are David Lynch nerds that as I got into it, like, it seemed like David, I didn't even have to know that it was David Lynch and watch it and be like, oh, this is David Lynch. I can get into more about why I think that is, but I really enjoyed it. And I know the conversations that I had had with the two of you was that this is one of the gentler Lynches.
Sure.
I really enjoyed it, and I've got a lot of thoughts about it.
Yeah, I grew up with a brother who really loved Lynch, so I know it very well, and I can talk it very well. Am I a massive David Lynch fan? Not really. Mm-hmm. I think two of his movies are masterpieces, and I think Twin Peaks is, like, one of the greatest shows of all time. I think everything else is sort of, like, an interesting piece of film, like, that I'm sort of like, sure, right? Like, that era really... Mm-hmm. As much as I think are curio pieces.
Right. I'm kind of with you on that. A friend of the pod, Michael Shaw Fisher, is a huge Lynch fan.
Once
I really figured out what he was doing, which is very different from anybody else, and anybody else who's considered avant-garde or a cult filmmaker, his is very specific. And once you get that and what he's trying to do with some of his crazier quote-unquote works, it becomes a little bit more illuminative, but I agree with you. I think there's two or three masterpieces, true masterpieces in it. And then you have like The Elephant Man, which I consider to be a very good film of his. And like The Straight Story, which is another one that's way more linear and grounded. That's I think is a very good film, but I'm kind of with you on that, Bailey. There's some of those I don't need to rewatch Wild at Heart necessarily.
That's one of the masterpieces, in my opinion.
Oh, but, okay.
We can talk. Right. But I love that movie. But I think it's more to me about, like, you might hear my child. She's crossing through. Grogu.
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 Hi.
Hi, baby. Waving at me. I forgot what I was talking about. Oh, my God. She's so cute. David Lynch. David Lynch.
Welcome to Baby Cast.
Yes. Let's just do that. Let's talk about it. Straight Story, you brought up, Scott, is a movie that's I think it's on Disney Plus right now. It is G-rated, and it is about a man who decides to ride a true story about a man who decides to ride his lawnmower across America. Yeah. And it is so watchable and
Which
so fun.
So Midwestern to me.
It's so Midwestern. Oh, it is. It I think is. He's like,
I mean, David Lynch is. David Lynch
David
is.
David Lynch is Midwestern.
He's a Midwestern guy. Like, you know, straight
Where?
Up. I forget. Let me look
I'll
that
be
up
the judge of
he's
that.
He's from Michigan. Am I crazy?
Oh, okay.
You look it up, Scott.
But I'm looking it up.
To me, Lynch is like, it's so interesting because this is probably his most populist film. This is his most, like this is the furthest, I think. Well, if you delete Straight Story, this is the furthest you get from, like, quote-unquote avant-garde Lynch. Now, there's the opening sequence and the closing sequence, which we can talk about, which they tried to cut.
Mm.
But besides that, this movie, I mean, it reads like anybody could have directed this. I think I said this to you, CJ, last night. I was like, the Coen brothers could have directed this movie, and I'd be like, sure.
Yeah.
Right? I'd believe you. There's some acting choices that are very Lynchian.
Sure.
There's a few Lynchian moments for sure.
Yeah.
I guess for me, since I've heard Lynch talked at me so much, I watched it and I was like, oh, that's Lynchy. Oh, that's Lynch. So, like, to me, it seemed like a very Lynch-esque film, but that's coming from somebody that's never ever watched Lynch before. So,
I would say, did you say where he was from? Did you find out?
Missoula, Montana.
Missoula, Montana.
Oh, that's not that's like that's the fucking really northern mountains.
Yeah, but even so, he's from. It's not bleh. It's just a different part of town. But it's the whole thing is.
I don't consider it the Midwest. That's
correct. It's okay. Not. It's not the Midwest. That is true. I think what Scott means by Midwest and what most people mean when they say Midwest is Middle America, and they don't mean literally middle of the country. They mean like the middle class of America and this sort of and that's kind of. That's the David Lynch vibe, and he's definitely playing to those sensibilities in a lot of his work, especially in Twin Peaks. But this film in particular, and I think CJ kind of mentioned this last night as well, but it got me thinking even more about it, is its relation to the Universal movie monster movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how it really feels like Dracula, Frankenstein,
Freaks in particular.
Freaks, of course. Yeah, yeah, Phantom of the Opera even. Like, it has these Wolfman, it has this kind of the tone. And Dracula in particular, actually, I kept feeling like, especially because of the lack of scoring sometimes, and the, you know, that kind of, I was like, ooh, Dracula. We're in Dracula, you know?
This was a movie made by a dude that is a nerd for old-timey monster movies.
Probably.
Old-timey film in general, I felt like.
Oh, yeah. And maybe, you see those techniques that are used
not
a
just
lot.
The black and white, which
right,
is obvious.
Right. But the techniques of, yeah, there's a lot of old. There are moments, I was even watching it earlier, there are moments where I was like, when was this shot? Is this in the 50s?
Right.
Right.
Like, you have those moments of sort of like, is this. But then you're like, no, he's homaging movies from the 30s. That's what he's doing.
Yeah.
But it's 1980, so we're, you know, it's a sensibility we're not getting a lot. We're not getting a lot of homage pieces in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. In the 90s and 2000s, I would argue, is when we start getting these homage pieces to, like, 70s films. And, like, I'm going to make a movie like Easy Rider. I'm going to make a movie like, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's just so interesting that he's, and it's very Lynchian, yes, to do that sort of before anybody else and then give it these avant-garde kicks. CJ.
Yes.
Before we get too deep.
Yes.
Can you break it the fuck down?
Absolutely.
CJ's breakdown.
John Merrick, which I found out he's actually Joseph Merrick. He's correct. Erroneously named John quite often. So correct. John Merrick, a man suffering from Proteus syndrome, is considered and treated like a freak in Victorian England. He's eventually found and rescued by Dr. Anthony Hopkins with hair and introduced to the beautiful world of normalcy. Unfortunately, not all of normal, with heavy quotes, England can let him live a much deserved quiet life.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of interesting things. So they think that he had, that one of his conditions may have been Proteus syndrome.
Right.
But they've never been able to prove it. And if it was, it was probably one of the most extreme versions ever. But they also think that he may have had another disease that caused his skeletal and spinal deformation as well, because they just... They weren't sure,
like
but
a spinal bifida,
like scoliosis,
thing,
like, or yeah, something
yeah,
worse,
yeah, yeah,
something like really intense,
something else,
like
because Proteus doesn't necessarily have a skeletal effect, except because of weight, because of the tumors, and he clearly
fascia,
was so. So yeah, so that's a interest. The other interesting thing was that, and then we can get into the movie a little bit more, but that he appeared to have had a semi-normal childhood in that the condition didn't start showing until he was like right pre-adolescent. So like when he
read five was when he started kind of showing.
Yeah,
stuff.
Which is when his mother passed away. Then his father kind of kicked him out. Then he lived with an uncle for a while. And then he was the one that sought out, I forget the character's name in the movie, but that's not the real person's name.
Bites.
Yeah.
Bites.
He decided to try and be in a freak show, that he thought that that was his really
right.
his only route.
He's so like, well, might as well make some money off of this.
But yeah, but was educated and could read, and you know, as they discover in the film. But yeah, just you know, a tragic life. You're just sort of there's something heartwarming that the end of his life was at least happy and fulfilling. But
something. This was the other thing to me that was so Lynchy, because of course while I was watching it, I went down like a Google rabbit hole about the syndrome and the actual person, Joseph Merrick,
mm-hmm.
And just Lynch movies in general, looking up pictures, figuring out what I'm going to watch next.
Yeah.
And there's something incredibly Lynchy to me that you're going to take to me, it was a film about kindness and treating people well and regardless of where they're from, what they look like, all that stuff. And for Lynch to make a movie like that and then have your protagonist be someone that at that time was perceived as a monster, like right. that seemed incredibly Lynchy to me.
Yeah, very much so. And I think the other thing that I sort of recalled in doing research and rewatching, because I was very young when it came out, but I remember when it came out, there was talked about the play, but it was very zeitgeisty. The Elephant Man was very zeitgeisty at that time. There were a lot of books mm-hmm. that came out. I think that there had been some documentation.
Well, this screenplay is based on two different books about the situation,
right? And I think that's because all of Treves' writings and diaries weren't released until later on. They weren't publicly accessible for a while, although I think he published a book as well. So it was very like you kind of saw it everywhere, which of course led to, you know, the Michael Jackson trying to buy the bones and all that stuff.
Well, and this is also the time when Circus Valentine came out. Like it was kind of a time in American pop culture where people were kind of fascinated by these things, and it came out in movies and art and literature.
Right. For sure. I mean, there's a lot of that going around in this time. And I think that it has its resurgence, actually, now and then. I would argue even, like, maybe in the early 2000s when, like, Carnival came out, we all got kind mm-hmm. of obsessed with it again.
Yeah,
for
and
sure.
then it kind of pulled away. And then I feel like maybe that's even coming back a little bit. There's, like, there's a few shows that are... I don't know. I could be wrong.
No, you're right. Because
no. I agree.
There was the Del Toro
that
flick that came out just a couple years ago.
Right. That's right.
Not Carnival Road. What was it called?
No, that's the show... I know what you're talking about.
But
it's
Bradley Cooper.
It's that thing where it's just with Bradley Cooper. Yeah, it's what was that called? Carnival Alley? Carnery Row?
Something like that.
Carnival Row? That sounds familiar, actually.
No, Carnival
That's
Row
a
is
show.
An Amazon Prime
That's show
with Orlando
okay.
Bloom. No, Hold what on. Is it? Cannery Row? No, the Dark Alley. The Alley of... what is it called?
I'm looking it up.
Look
okay,
it up.
Good. I'm not going to look
I'm
it
looking
up.
Looking it up.
It's speaking of Bradley Cooper, there was a rendition on Broadway with Bradley Cooper of the original 1977 play, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, really?
That was my question. How much of the script is the play, or was
100%
it two different things?
0%. Okay, cool. Yeah, is how I should say that.
Two different things.
Two totally different things. So I thought it was based on, and then today I was reading about it, and I went, wait. Because at the beginning of the movie, it says based on, and it lists two books. I assumed the first one was just the play because it was called The Elephant Man.
Sure.
But then I was thinking, and then I looked at my script later and I went, oh, wait, that's not the same author. So I looked it up. There is a book called, there's a book called The Elephant Man and another book called, like, The Case of the Elephant Man and the Documents That Treves Left. You know, it's like a long medical, whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what the movie is based on, is those two texts. Specifically, Mel Brooks, famous satirist, Mel Brooks, was the one who, I guess, apparently did not see the play, but knew of the buzz around it. In 1977, the play comes out by Bernard Pomerantz, and does very well, wins a lot of Tonys. It's had many, many revivals that have won Tonys, and I think 2015 it won Best Revival of the Play. Like, it always does well. In fact, I think
Merrick
Bradley Cooper won a Tony. No, he was nominated. Billy Crudup was nominated. Patricia Clarkson was in it once. Like, yeah.
David Bowie did it.
Bowie did it.
I don't.
Bowie's
I don't
a Lynch
know
acolyte.
How popular or good the play is, as I've not been exposed to it. But from from what I've heard from it, it's like a big movement thing for the actor.
It is.
Playing
the actor
Merrick.
Usually doesn't wear any makeup at all.
Correct. And so, like, to me, it almost feels like it would be another one of those, like, Hamlet, Lear, Richard III type roles of, like, something you've really got to take on and put a lot of your guts into.
I would argue Treves is that role, though, in the play.
Oh.
Only
okay.
And here's why. Here's why. Because I think Dysart is that role in Equus. And that's the play is more Equus-like, where it is more about... It actually, it's very Equus-like in the way that even... In the play, there's almost like a sexual relationship between Treves and Merrick. There's this kind of like his obsession with him has this sexuality to it. That's almost like he's intrigued with him beyond just the medical or just the wanting to save him or just there's this kind of like extra. And that's the Dysart Alan Strang sort of relationship.
Yeah,
in Equus, which we should. Oh, God, we got to do Schaffer.
What are we
doing?
We'll do Schaffer next
year. It's
been
years since I've read Equus. I hardly remember it.
Good play. But we got to get into it. But I think the play does get in a little bit more into that. And just to speak to the differences real quick so we can step away from the play, because I know that's not what we're here to talk about. But like you said, Scott, correct. Merrick doesn't wear prosthetics. It becomes more of like a movement thing and like he's really committing to the role, like you said, Siege. But through most of the play, he is sort of treated as an object. It's more of like this mirror for us to learn things about other characters and like how they treat him.
Okay.
But also the movie is a little bit more brutal to him, I would argue. I was just flipping through it because I read it in college and I saw it at Antaeus when my directed, I believe, by Dakin Matthews. My brother was dating his son at the time and was stage managing it. And I was like 14 and I flew out and saw it and loved it. I was like, oh, this play rules. And then watched the movie way later. Mm-hmm. So I was actually maybe, I was definitely introduced to the play before I was the movie. But the play is a little bit nicer to him. Whereas the movie is like, no, he's abused. He is abused by the guy in the, which he probably was, to be clear. I mean, I think the movie might be even more true to how he was treated. Yeah. But in the play, it's a little more ambiguous whether or not Bites, but in the play, his name is, I think, Ross. Just how whether or not he's beating him is a little bit more like, I don't know, maybe he is. Mm-hmm. I can't tell. But the play just makes it less obvious. It's very interesting.
Theater Easter egg in The Elephant Man. Who played Bites's little boy that followed him around?
Who was it? I didn't look it up.
Yeah, it's somebody, but I can't remember now.
Dexter Fletcher, director of Rocket Man.
Is that him?
Crazy. Yeah, that's
no way.
Awesome.
I was just looking on IMDb.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, because I was like, John Gielgud. What else have I mean, obviously,
well,
huge
we know
name.
John Gielgud.
Who
yeah.
is he in this? Because I hadn't gotten to his entrance yet. And I was like, who is this guy playing? And then Dexter Fletcher popped up. And I was like, he plays the little boy in this. That's amazing.
That's a big deal to me, actually.
Yeah,
that's
really cool.
I didn't even realize that.
Deep
that's
cut.
Massive.
Nice Easter egg. Yeah.
Well done. Good
find. They did that especially for us 43 years ago.
While we're at it, let's talk a little bit. Well, I wanted to finish the Mel Brooks thing real quick.
Yes.
Yeah,
Mel Brooks.
It's really interesting. And the story, there's a little story that I think is fucking brilliant, but go ahead.
Well, I might tell it, I might not. I don't know where you're headed with that. But basically Mel Brooks, who was the one who went to David Lynch and said, I want you to write and direct this. And he also got the permission to... What?
Right. No, this is what I had read.
Yeah.
That one of Mel Brooks's guys who was part of the production company. And we should also shout out that it wasn't just Mel Brooks's production company. It was his and Anne Bancroft's production company together.
That's true.
That he was like, you need to check out this guy, Lynch. And so they did a screening of Eraserhead with David Lynch and Mel Brooks watching Eraserhead together. And Siege, at some point you'll watch Eraserhead, but you'll...
I looked up pictures of it.
It's fucking nuts. But that they finished and Mel Brooks was like, you're my guy.
Yeah, so... Well, and it has that, you know, there's definitely some... Okay, so Eraserhead is the movie that David Lynch makes out of American Film Institute. Mm-hmm. He graduates American Film Institute. His thesis film, he made a bunch of like little, you know, shorts and stuff, but then and that are all really creepy. And then he makes this thesis film that gets him the money to make Eraserhead. He shoots it all on the AFI backlot. That whole thing is shot at the American Film Institute, which is fucking crazy.
You're right.
And why a lot of people really respect the movie, because it is epically... It is so production designed for something that was shot on a school backlot. It's just crazy. it's amazing. But Lynch didn't make any money off of that movie. Zero money.
No.
And goes and he becomes a roofer.
Yes.
David Lynch is working as a roofer when he gets a call from Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft's company. And they say, hey, we want to screen this movie and watch, you know, see if Mel Brooks likes it. And he's like, oh, fuck. And so it was a huge deal for David Lynch.
That's cool.
This is a massive, massive deal,
he's
which I love.
He's just like us.
Yeah.
Or was just like us.
Yeah. It's kind of cool, though. I will say this. Mel Brooks took his name off of the movie because he was worried people would walk in thinking, is this just another Young Frankenstein? Is
like
this
a funny,
another?
Like a comedy.
Goofy.
Yeah.
Sure.
Exactly. Which I probably would.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It was a really smart, respectful decision to do that. And because they went on to do like three or four other small, very indie films that you wouldn't associate with Mel Brooks at all. But it was all his company doing it.
Hmm.
Yeah. This is also the movie that made the Academy Awards reconsider makeup as a Oscar.
Cool.
Yeah,
basically, there was this huge outcry.
Yeah, they
people
went.
Were
they
pissed.
Went and like were like, you have to give a special award to this movie,
yeah.
and they
didn't
do it. But they did.
They wouldn't do
the
it. But then the next year, they built the category, and then they did some. Old movie. They gave some to old movies.
Did they
celebrate Lon Chaney or anything?
They didn't. Did. They did his Hunchback of Notre Dame, but they didn't. They only did Jekyll and Hyde, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the 1931, and The Wizard of Oz, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And then there's like three others, I think, but I actually don't have that list. I should have looked that up.
No.
That's cool.
By the way, I thought this was interesting. An angry mob is chasing Merrick at one point when he returns to London.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that part?
He's like down in the underground.
Yeah.
Yes.
In the tube.
Lynch is in the scene and I caught his face.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Yes.
Ah, right on.
Lynch is in it full costume, like running like Merrick. Like, and then there's another really cool cameo. Dr. Frederick Treves' great nephew.
Yeah, I read this. Yeah.
Is in the opening scene as an alderman trying to close down the freak show.
That's cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
I don't know. I thought those were cool little tidbits of info.
Well, and then the other cool cameo, it's more than a cameo, is Kenny Baker. R2-D2 himself.
Where is he in the movie?
Oh.
He's one of the little people that helps him
escape. That is Kenny Baker.
It's Kenny Baker.
Right. One of the time bandits.
Yeah. And he's the one that sends him off on the boat. And... There's
Star
a great
Wars is
shot of
everything,
him.
Everything, y'all.
His face was Star Wars is in everything. Well, and then because of this, and because of Eraserhead, he was offered Return of the Jedi. David Lynch was to direct and turned it down to do Dune.
He wouldn't have, And then he would do
Dune.
Dune is 4 years after this. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
next is Blue Velvet, then Dune.
Correct. We don't have to get into it right now. Blue Velvet's not one of my Lynch movies.
Well, it's one of mine.
Just saying.
It's one of mine.
I still need to watch Dune. I've just heard
Dune
so many people trash it that I
It's fun, but if you love the book, you're not going to like the movie. And if you love the new movie, you're really not going to like the whole movie.
I mean, I'll get to it one of these days.
It's fun. It's Kyle MacLachlan. It's fine. Yeah. The production design is what's cool about that movie.
Yeah, there's some stunning
There's some cool looking stuff. But it's also Lynch being like, fuck Herbert. I'm going to do my own thing. And you're like, oh. Okay.
Sounds like Jodorowsky.
Correct. Yeah, Jodorowsky and Lynch live in kind of the same vein for me in that same reason where I'm sort of like, I get it. Not for me. It's just not all for me. Some of it is. Yeah. Okay, last thing, because we brought it up and we didn't get into it, the makeup.
Oh, yeah. I want to know how long he had to fucking get into costume and makeup.
So the story was it took 7 or 8 hours to get into it, 2 hours to get out of it. Yeah. So he would have to show up at 5 a.m. and then he would leave at about 11 p.m. And John Hurt was it was so much that he started to hate acting. And he wrote his girlfriend. He's like, I didn't think anything would ever make me hate acting. Yeah. So Lynch was like, cool, we'll do it every other day. So they would he would come in every other day. So he would have a day
get
to recoup.
A good day's sleep.
And then they would shoot as much as they could in the in between days. But
The 8 hours getting in sounds awful, but to be honest, the 2 hours getting out would be the worst part.
Yeah,
because I'd just be at the end of the day and I'd be like, get me out of this.
Right, and the whole thing is like, well, we're using it the next time too, so we can't just destroy it and it just takes forever.
Yeah, they had to take care of the
prosthetics. There were 14 pieces that, not including the head.
Oof. And that seemed like the hardest part.
The head was its own singular piece, but it apparently weighed a shit ton.
Sure.
They had to be applied exactly the same for continuity, obviously.
Sure.
And they couldn't afford to make a mistake, which is why it took so long. But Wally Schneiderman is the makeup artist, so I want to shout him out. Mm-hmm. And he considers it the hardest picture he's ever had to do. For that reason, because of the continuity and all that kind of shit.
Is there other cool shit that he's done?
He did Chaplin. He was, which was the Robert Downey Jr. Charlie Chaplin movie. He did the original Rollerball, which rules and has some cool stuff. He did Dirty Dozen. Guns of Navarone, which I've never seen.
Oh, Guns of Navarone? Oh, my God. We'll have to talk about Guns of Navarone sometime.
Yeah.
It's an amazing movie.
He is the makeup supervisor of Labyrinth.
All right, there we go. That's what I was waiting for.
Yeah,
okay,
now
cool,
we know.
Cool.
Well,
and
he's
chief makeup artist on Yentl and a bunch of other kind of more theater-based stuff, which is cool. Yeah.
He also designed a very famous... Richard III stage version that Tony Shear did in the early 80s.
I've heard all about this Tony Shear production.
Yeah, where they deformed him so he had, a very grotesque sort of lump on his back and all that. And people apparently would gasp when the lights would come up and he would come out. But
This is worth mentioning actually about him just because I'm going through his IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
Before he started being chief and supervisor on movies, he was a makeup artist on Fiddler on the Roof.
Nice.
And in a couple of those Hammer Christopher Lee Dracula movies, including Scars of Dracula, which is my favorite.
Okay. Cool.
Which is very cool. And I think maybe why he ends up heading towards this film. All right. Which is awesome.
That's cool. I love that.
Yeah.
Really cool. Sorry, I'm just going through his shit and being like, my God, he's done everything.
Well, and the other interesting thing is they made the molds from the casts of Joseph Merrick.
It's like based on his actual face. They had done
casts of him when he died, and so the British Museum had them, so they were able to get access and actually make molds that they were able to. So it's very accurate.
Guy.
If you look at the real photographs versus what they did, it's shockingly accurate. So
I wanted to shout out the other two screenplay, the other two writers of the screenplay, because it's David Lynch did write it, but then Christopher DeVore and Eric Berggren are also
I think they
cited,
did the original draft.
Where have I seen
they did
the
original
DeVore
draft
name
of the
before?
DeVore, nothing you would. I don't think anything.
I don't know why that name is ringing a bell in my head.
He wrote the Mel Gibson Hamlet screenplay.
I've heard that's the worst Hamlet, isn't it?
It's the worst Hamlet. It's such a dumb cut.
It makes no sense. It doesn't make sense.
Glenn Close is Gertrude, yeah, right? Yeah. I don't remember it that well.
Yeah,
but
it's not great.
And then Eric Berggren, who co-wrote the movie Francis with Christopher Devore. Did you ever see Francis?
It's
like 1982. It's young. Jessica, what's her name? Jessica Lange.
Jessica Lange. Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I love her, but
it's Frances Fisher, right? Is the story? No, wait.
Oh, maybe.
Oh, yeah. The one that Nirvana wrote that song about.
Right.
Sure. But that's all they've ever done. Those are their, you know, Eric Berggren died in Pasadena, California in 2016. So sad. But it's just sort of one of those things where it's like, that's their whole IMDb. They did three projects and they did them together. And one of them was with Lynch and kind of crazy. And I think part of the reason why maybe it wasn't like script wise wasn't considered as a massive deal as maybe it could have been is that the play was 3 years before and was considered like one of the great scripts. And I just don't think the script lives up to what they're doing there. Last little Mel Brooks story. I keep forgetting I wanted to tell this. The only tiny little thing is that David Lynch gets the job. He makes the movie and then they're screening it for Paramount.
Okay.
And Paramount watches the movie and they come in and they're like, okay, we love the movie. It's fantastic. It's going to make millions. It didn't. But they're like, what if we took out all the avant-garde bullshit?
The beginning and the end, particularly.
And the dream sequence. And
Mel Brooks was like, haha, fucking hilarious. And his exact quote was, we are involved in a business venture. We screened the film for you to bring you up to date as to the status of that venture. Do not misconstrue this as our soliciting the input of raging primitives. Wow.
Ooh, go Mel Brooks.
And it's honestly, like, I was like, yeah, fuck producers. Like, all of a sudden, like, I don't know why. Like, fuck the studios. And it's part of, like, we're in the WGA shit right now. We're in all this stuff. And I was just like, yes. Like, I wish people like Mel, it didn't have to take Mel Brooks to be able to say that as a creator.
Right.
To be able to say, no, this is the art I would like to put out. Fuck you. And he had to be Mel Brooks to be able to say that and not get blacklisted.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the worst part about the whole studio system. Anyway, okay. Just wanted to make that clear.
No.
May I shout out two moments in the film that like really got me and made me cry?
Yes.
And
we should go through the cast.
I know y'all roll. I don't know that y'all agree with me that I think it's a film about kindness, but I really do.
I absolutely do.
Yeah.
The scene where he meets the doctor's wife and she's just like nice to him.
Yeah. And he cries.
And he cries. And
I'm just not used to a beautiful woman looking at me. And he's like, oh.
And then, I mean, this is part human but also part actor when he's in the theater and just being in the theater and seeing him experience that, especially after I can't remember what the character was, but that lady came in and told him that the theater is the most beautiful thing on earth.
And bankrupt,
but then them giving him a standing ovation and particularly the interaction with Trevi's wife or Treve. It just reminded me. It's a good reminder. Hey, everybody, why don't you just fucking be nice to people on your day to day? Because it reminds me of, I will have the shittiest fucking work week where I just can't do anything right. I'm letting everybody down, or at least I think I am. And then my boss says, like, thank you. And then I get in my car and cry the whole way home.
Yeah. No, it goes a long way. It really does. My favorite moment to dovetail off of that real quick, the moment that just got to me as a student, and I still think it's just a brilliant, elegant choice, is the scene with the two of them in his room together, and they're talking, and Merrick asks Treves, can you fix me?
Yeah.
And there's not a moment of hesitation. There's not a beat. There's not an error. Anthony Hopkins that character knew that the question was going to come to him.
Yes.
And he wasn't going to give him that hope. And so he answers as honestly and bluntly and as kindly as he possibly can. And I think it's just an amazing, simple choice moment. Because my instinct, because I like to chew things, is I would have put as much air in that fucking thing as possible. I would have been like, no. And he doesn't. It's just, no, can't.
He's a nice human, but he's also a good doctor, too, you know?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And that whole scene where he also is like, am I a good person? The scene with the nurse, and we need to call out her name.
That was a great scene. We'll step through I loved that scene.
Yeah, let's step through that. But that was a fantastic scene. And that actress is loaded, and she's a two-time Oscar.
You talking about Motherhead?
Nom.
Mother's Head?
Yeah.
Wendy Hiller. Wendy Hiller.
Her arc in the show is great.
It is great.
She's got a great arc.
You don't expect it to be, because you only see her a couple times earlier on, and you're just like, oh, she's one of the nurses, and then you're sort of like, oh, she has a whole arc.
Yeah, she's
and
got
so
a
So do the younger nurse that first gets scared of him.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, all of them, they're really good. She, by the way, we'll step through it all, but Wendy Hiller is the best part of the original Murder on the Orient Express. She's Princess Natalia. She's like, and she's in Man for All Seasons and all that shit.
And nominated for Best Actress for Pygmalion in 1938.
Pygmalion, that's right, for the original Eliza Doolittle.
She was the original.
You don't sigh.
Yeah.
Don't sigh.
Yeah. Don't sigh. Okay. Let's step through this cast a little bit. We down for that?
Yes.
So, obviously, I think we need to start with Anthony Hopkins. Now, I'm a big stan of Anthony Hopkins. We've talked about it on the podcast before. He's one of those dudes who will basically sign on to anything, especially if he reads something like a Marvel movie. He will write really big on each page, N-A-R. Mm-hmm. No acting required.
Yes,
and those are his favorite projects. Because he's like, hey, I'll make a few million to just be Odin in a few movies. I'm a big Anthony Hopkins fan. I also often ask people on a scale from 1 to Anthony Hopkins, like, how are you doing right now?
people usually
don't know how to answer it. I like him a lot. He's great in this film. He's phenomenal in this film.
That moment where he sees him for the first time and the tears just come. And it's great because Lynch lets the camera sit. You and I talked yesterday briefly, Bailey, about that it's slow. It is slow.
It is slow.
But he allows moments
exceedingly
to
watchable.
I
like just slow movies that are watchable.
And this
slow movies
just
that aren't watchable fucking blow.
But this one was just letting those moments breathe and letting. He also had. We should shout out DP on the film too, because there's just some stunning shots, but some really stunning shots of eyes. You notice the eyes are a theme throughout the whole thing, and the way they catch. You know, John Hurt's eyes, but especially in that scene with Hopkins, he's great. He's so handsome when he was younger.
Ooh.
Such a handsome
dude. I'm not used to young Anthony Hopkins. He's been like grandpa age.
Y'all ever seen the movie Magic?
Oh, yeah.
He is not handsome in that movie. He is frightening in that movie.
Yes, well,
the movie, Magic is about he's also Hannibal Lecter. 20 years later, but yes. I do think there's this kind of like, if you watch the movie Magic, it's about a guy who has a puppet. He's a ventriloquist, and the dummy comes to life, or he thinks it does. I don't really remember it. I saw it as a kid, and it terrified me.
Horrific.
Anyway, we should say this just because I'll forget to say it later. This won 0 Oscars,
but was nominated for like 8
Best Picture, Best Director, John Hurt for Best Actor, not Hopkins. Adapted Screenplay. Art Direction, which we should look up what won, because damn.
I thought the production design in this was gorgeous.
Yeah.
Agreed. Costume design was gorgeous. Film editing was weird and cool.
Yeah.
And could have easily won. And Best Original Score. It was nominated for all of those. It was edited by Anne V. Coates.
No way.
That rules.
Wow. Wow, that's cool.
She did Out of Sight, In the Line of Fire.
She's been a legend.
This is before Lynch was Lynch and people didn't know that they wanted it.
Correct.
right.
No, that's true, but also Lynch has never even been considered for an Oscar after this. That's his only Oscar nom, right?
Okay.
Oh, no, did Mulholland Drive get an Oscar nom?
I guess he just has fucking following.
He may have gotten one for Blue Velvet, because that was a huge critical shockwave. You know, people did not expect that thing.
He's, well, it's so interesting because he's sort of the most, sorry to get back into Lynch talk, but he is sort of the most art house film director that is populist in some way. Though I don't think any of his movies are populist. I think he's popular is maybe the better way to say it.
Yeah, I agree.
But he had, let's see, I just wanted to see what he's been nominated for. He's only been nominated for two Oscars, and it was Best Director and Best Adapted Screenplay for The Elephant Man.
Wow. That's
all
crazy.
Of his other, I'm sorry. No, wait, nope. I'm way off base. I apologize. Best Director, Blue Velvet, nomination, not a win.
I was pretty sure.
Good call. My apologies.
You should be sorry.
I am. I'm very sorry. You know, he wins the Palme d'Or a few times. With Wild at Heart wins the Palme d'Or. He does things like that. Fire Walk with Me was nominated for the Palme d'Or, which is crazy to me because I actually don't think that movie's very good.
No.
The Straight Story was nominated for Palme d'Or. Mulholland Drive, he gets another Best Director nomination. Inland Empire, nothing, because nobody liked that movie except the Venice Film Fest. And that's it. That's all he's ever been nominated for. So I was wrong. He has been nominated for a few things, but he's never won. And he's sort of the closest thing that like an avant-garde auteur art house director has ever gotten to popularity, which is really cool to think about.
You know who he's good buddies with?
He's also
with?
A transcendental meditationalist.
He is. He's
cool.
Got the David
who's
Lynch
he buddies
Society.
With?
Spike Lee. He and
really?
Spike Lee.
That's cool.
They've been on juries together, and I guess they just love the shit out of each other's movies.
I love that.
That would be a party. Yeah. That would be a cool party to go to.
Yeah. I think, and there's been a lot of discussion around Lynch whether or not he's a feminist, a misogynist. I think those conversations are always a part of every discussion in art, obviously. My take after watching Twin Peaks The Return is that his whole point of the original Twin Peaks was the opposite of how everybody took it, unfortunately.
Man,
and that just sucks. And there's nothing we can do about
Responsible
that.
Responsible viewing. We keep talking about it.
We talk about it constantly. Yeah. Constantly. Yeah.
It's been a theme this season with us,
it
specifically.
Has. I've also, I maybe shouldn't say this. I won't say who it was with or what all of it was about, but I got into a pretty heated, I wouldn't say argument because there was no discussion had. I was just told I was wrong about Tar. The other day.
Oh.
And Tar being a movie that is very difficult and nuanced and has a lot going on in it and has it's not very obvious about what it's trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
This person was saying it is, no matter what you say, in 100% misogynistic film. And I was saying I just don't agree with that. And there was no nuanced discussion to be had. It was just, it's either that or it's not that, and you don't get to tell me I'm wrong. And I was like, I just want to have a discussion. Like, I just want to talk. I just want to know why. I'm not even telling you you're wrong. Yeah. I'm telling you I would love to understand, you know. My take is that why would Kate Blanchett build a character with Todd Field that was a misogynistic character? But, you know, okay, well, fuck me, right?
Right.
Outside of that, though.
Fuck you, Bailey.
Fuck me. But, CJ, I think you're right. I think we're just, people have to view things responsibly. And by viewing things responsibly, I don't think it's the artist's job.
No,
does that
I mean
make
it's
sense?
The yeah, it's the age old, you know, I think I've mentioned it on this, but it's the Bob Dylan thing. He's never talked about any of his work. He ducks and weaves and he's like, it's not up to me to tell you what it
is. That's right.
It's just not. And I think that that's very much Lynch. Take this as you will, you know, I can't.
Right. I want to clarify what I said. I think it is the artist's responsibility not to put things out there that are harmful. I don't. That's obvious.
Sure. Yeah, that's a different part of it.
That's different. But I think the way we consume things, like the way, like I think a lot of the time when a character says something, we will be like, "Well, the author is saying that,"
right?
And it's like, or are they trying to tell you something about that character? And that's the discussion that always has to be had.
A good case in point for this, Lolita, the book, and every iteration of it. It's the same thing. And there's no way that we can know because Nabokov.
Yeah. Nabokov.
He's dead and didn't talk about it.
He didn't really talk about it. He talked about his past traumas and he talked about in a very minute way what he intended in like a one sentence was not to be
right.
Was to have us question it. That is right. It. That's what right. He intended.
I think
which is what makes that book what it is. But
I think what's cool about art is people can interpret it in different yes. ways. I think the responsibility part is then having conversations about
correct.
It.
Correct. And hearing each other's point of views and not saying you're fucking wrong and here's why. Like
sure.
It's hearing it and going, interesting, I disagree, you know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Also the difference between consuming pop culture and consuming what attempts to be culture.
Correct.
Do you know what I mean? And I don't mean that in a pretentious way, but take a movie like Tar. Tar is not a movie that was meant to make,
make
$250 million. No. This was about something deeper. And
an artistic discussion being had between Todd Field, Kate Blanchett, and America.
The audience. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
the
world. Gandalf.
And Gandalf.
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 Gandalf. Gandalf. Hey, you can say that now. You're a hobbit in your prime.
That's true. I've hit my 33 years. I want to say this because I'm obsessed with it. The way that they say the things in the movies are how I want everybody to say things in all fantasy movies. Like, Mordor. Like, they don't say Mordor. They're like, Mordor.
No, that's what I love about Rings of Power, that Morfrid Clark. What's her? Morfrid. That gal has the H in front of all of her R's.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, she does it better than everyone in Lord of the Rings.
Well, it's like the way everybody says Harry Potter in the Harry Potter movie. Harry Potter.
Yeah, rules. Rules. Okay.
Real quick, I just wanted to get back to John Hurt real quick.
Yes, okay, I was about to get us back to this guy.
Thank you.
Speaking of Harry Potter.
Speaking of wands.
Like, when you think about all that makeup, because I keep trying to see him, I keep trying to hear him, because John Hurt eventually got the John Hurt smoking voice.
Yeah, the storyteller. Jim Henson's the storyteller is how I think of John Hurt.
Right, yeah.
Hello. Yes. You, Mr. Potter.
He's the one. He says it too.
Mr. Potter.
But how good he is. And when you watch him, like, in all those scenes where he's running or moving and he is all twisted up and it's all his eyes, he's pitching up his voice, he's clearly got to affect his speech.
All the spit stuff.
I wondered if he breathing. Had stuff stuffed in his mouth.
Well,
too.
He clearly had a prosthetic denture in his mouth.
Right.
In the corner that lifted up.
I wondered
up there.
If he was even having to suck the spit out himself. Like, it sounds like he's doing it and not ADR'd.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's doing it. And. Yeah. Because it's such a part of the speech. And that's masterwork. I mean, that's a theater actor who's putting all of their skills and all of their learning into a very difficult, very difficult role. Because how was that dude not just angry at the world?
Yeah.
Angry at his situation, bitter. Yeah. And he wasn't.
Well, and he's only
he
21.
Just...
I think that's something that's very
when
interesting.
When they found
yeah.
him, he was 21.
Yeah. 21.
Well, when you're treated like trash your whole life and like you're a weirdo, after a while, you're like, well, I must be.
Right, yeah. I guess.
I mean, that's one way you can go, you know?
I wonder if he got any therapy.
It is a great moment, though, when
in that economy?
He's not mm-hmm. speaking and he's not speaking and John Gielgud comes in and finally... They leave the room and John Gielgud's like, it's not going to work. He's incurable. And then Merrick starts reciting the full Psalm 23 or whatever it is.
Yes.
And then is basically can speak way more and just admits right away. He's like, I'm so sorry. I was just so afraid. And now I see you are trying to help me. I totally understand. Yeah. And you're just like, oh shit. It's a great moment.
Yeah.
Great moment. John Hurt, man.
John Hurt.
Pass or fail.
Legend.
I'm kidding.
Oh, my
Everyone
God.
Everyone has.
You're right.
There's no failures here.
Yeah.
He's a legend. We stand a legend. And
miss
rest
him.
In peace.
We miss him so much.
Yeah. He went too soon.
Another rest in peace, Anne Bancroft as Mrs. Kendall.
Oh, just a lovely performance. And just sincere. Yeah. Like, the nurse in that speech, talks about people, it's like now people are still just exploiting him. They just want to see him so they can tell their friends that they saw him.
Yeah.
All that stuff. But she's like, I need to meet this other human being. And then the reciting of the the Shakespeare, and what a lovely scene. Yeah,
I'm a huge Graduate fan. It's one of my top movies. Yes. I think it's perfectly directed film, and she is incredible in that movie.
Yeah. Oh my God.
We love Anne Bancroft and wife of Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Yes.
They only did a couple movies together where they acted together, acted together, and one of them in particular is To Be or Not to Be, which I think is kind of a bad movie.
Oh, it's awful.
And then there's the other one that what was it called, Scott? It's like 80th.
Something Street, yeah. Also with Anthony Hopkins.
That one's supposed to be cute, though.
It's really sweet. It's about a relationship between two bookstore owners, Anthony Hopkins in England and Anne Bancroft in New York in the 50s and 60s. And they just have a relationship via letters. And then you see their lives as they exchange these letters across the Atlantic. It's a charming little film, yeah.
Sounds like Intimate Apparel.
But it's not
84 evil. Charing Cross Road.
That's it. Oh, okay. 84 Charing Cross Road. Yeah.
And obviously we talked about Night Mother on the podcast. She's Thelma in the original Night Mother with Sissy Spacek. Agnes of God, she's in the movie. She's in she did a lot of plays to film, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
She's also in the
Miracle
very
Worker.
Famous Miracle Worker. That's right. I forgot about that. She is the Miracle Worker herself. And she is, I remember there's this 70s Jesus TV miniseries that was really famous that I remember renting from Blockbuster as a kid called Jesus of Nazareth, and she was Mary Magdalene.
And she's
that.
Mary Magdalene in it,
kind of crazy. Yeah.
Nice pull. Good pull.
Yeah.
Bailey.
Stupid pull. Stupid pull. We stand a legend, and she's great in this, and I love the first time we meet her, and she's just like, well, I guess I'll have to meet this man. I would rather like to, you know, that kind of shit. Rules. Okay. John Gielgud.
Yeah.
Oh, man. He's so good in this. This is like, and this is right at that era towards the end of his life where he starts playing the head of British institutions.
Yes.
Like, you know, he's the head of the hospital here. And
what he would have done in real life if he hadn't been an actor.
Yeah, right. In Chariots of Fire, he's the head of Cambridge. And, you know, he starts playing all
the. He played
roles.
Merlin about 500 times.
Just like, absolutely.
Or not Merlin, but like things in King Arthur's court. Not necessarily Merlin.
Yeah, yeah.
I just remember he was on the TV miniseries Merlin when I was a kid. He's in tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of shit.
Oh my God.
He's around forever.
Theater and film. I knew him as a kid because he showed up in things like the Merlin miniseries and whatnot. But when we're at Shakespeare Youth Fest, the way that we describe a kid who is well beyond their years as an actor will go, they're a John Gielgud. They're a Gielgud, and people love that. He was Cassius in the 1953 Julius Caesar film.
Okay.
Yeah. He's also in Murder on the Orient Express. He's Beidos in that. And obviously he's in Arthur.
Oh,
you guys
my
remember
God.
Arthur?
Oh, my
the
God.
Year after
he's
this,
got
he's
one of the
Arthur.
Greatest quotes in film history. Perhaps you'd like me to come in there and wash your dick for you, you little shit. It's just fucking great.
He's in Caligula.
He is in Caligula.
We stan.
Yeah.
I'm just looking through. He was in the show. He was in the play Galileo, and then made the movie and a bunch of shit. He's John Gielgud. We stan a legend. He's phenomenal in this film.
He's fine.
You don't like him?
I'm kidding. He's fine.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he's great in this.
He's fine.
He's just very the character. There's really no other.
Sure.
It was like him or bust. Wendy Hiller, we already talked about as Mother's Head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She's phenomenal. She's
great.
My MVP of the movie is Freddie Jones as Bites.
Mm-hmm.
He was good.
It's a really great performance.
That performance and those choices.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's got a great IMDb. He's what's his name? In Dune. He's in Lynch Dune.
He's
Hawat?
It starts with a TH, doesn't it?
Thufir Hawat.
Oh, that one. Yeah, him.
He's in the Lynch Dune.
He's in the Lynch Dune. He's good in it. He's weird looking and it's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
He's in Krull, which is one of my favorite fantasy movies of all time.
CJ, you never have to see Krull.
You don't have to see Krull. Krull is stupid. And then he was part of Brechtenko.
Yeah.
He was in Brecht & Co., which is kind of cool. We talked about Brecht & Co. a lot in our Brecht miniseries, which
yeah,
is kind of rad.
Yeah, but just one of those hustlers, character actors who worked forever and ever.
A couple other people I think are worth mentioning. Dexter Fletcher, obviously fantastic as the child. You also have the younger nurse was played by Leslie Dunlop.
She's the one
who gets scared of him first.
Yeah.
And then comes back in. I hadn't heard of her, but she was great.
She's one of those ones that just, she was on, she's been on stage in BBC for 40 years.
Yes, yeah, correct. And she was in the Little Night Music movie in the 70s, it looks like. And then, let me find it. Oh, Michael Elphick as the night porter, the guy who is sort of pulling the Kill Bill on Uma Thurman. People are paying him to sneak into the ward at night and see John Merrick.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of abuses him and is like really and brings the woman in and all that shit.
Yeah.
Tough character, but well acted.
Yeah, for sure.
All right.
That scene when he's reading the letter from the newspaper to all the guys in the bar, and he's just like, they're going to take our money. And I'm like, oh, shit. And then Mrs. Treves, I think, is worth mentioning. Hannah Gordon.
Yeah, very good.
She was really great. The other one that's actually a good performance as well, John Standing as Fox, as the one who is his sort of his friend who's kind of at first like, what are you of no importance? What are you up to? He gives a good little performance.
And he's
as
another
well.
One of those British character actors who just worked forever.
I know him from V for Vendetta. He is
in V for Vendetta. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. It's a good movie.
Good movie.
Good movie. People don't talk about it enough.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
It lives. It's in the zeitgeist. You know, the Guy Fawkes mask is still the only thing that Anonymous uses as their, like,
yeah, remember their Anonymous? And they were going to save the world.
Yeah, good for them. did you guys have anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, thanks for indulging me as always. This was a good pull. I'm glad I rewatched it, and just some just great fucking work and great direction, great photography and great music,
atmosphere and
set design, and yeah, it's just it's one of those movies that's really hard to watch. Always been very difficult for me to watch, but
it's sad.
But it's worth it. It's worth it for the work.
The last thing I wanted to say was about production design, which was early on in the first, all of it's cool. The gas lights and the, you know, all the gas lanterns and shit. I'm just like, oh, I love this shit. And anytime they're outside in the Victorian like area, I'm just like, oh, this rules. But the surgery scene at the beginning, when they're doing all the pulleys shit, and the guy, and he's like, oh, machines can't reason with them, you know, like whatever.
Yeah,
and they're
doing
surgery on the guy. There is an amazing offhand throwaway moment where Anthony Hopkins is like, okay, give me this thing. And then he coughs.
Oh, yeah.
But he just coughs directly into the wound.
And
you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
And like my brain like exploded. I was like, no, you can't do that. Especially like post-COVID. I'm like,
no.
But it's kind of an amazing moment, like Lynchian moment of him being like, I'm not going to point out how fucked up the medical shit was at this time. I'm just going to show you for a second. like, it's really cool. Really smart.
Yeah.
Okay. See, do you have anything else you want to say?
No, I finally got into David Lynch, and now I suppose I should do some other stuff so everyone around me will be like, have you seen that? You should see it. So,
yeah, I don't know.
We could do a double feature, Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart.
I was about to say, I think Lynch, much like Jodorowsky, is better enjoyed as a viewing with others.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because some of his movies, especially, I mean, this movie proves this, but a lot of his movies are even more so, are very sparse and sad and sorrowful and kind of depressive. And I would argue, like, I don't watch Lynch films alone. Like, I would probably not do well if I sat down and watched Inland Empire and then tried to go to sleep. Like, I would have to think about it for 6 hours. So it's always fun to have the conversation surrounding it, I would argue. But also, like, do you watch whatever the fuck you want? He's made a lot of really interesting shit.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff that people fucking hate.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, everyone should consume Twin Peaks at some point. I think it's what created modern television.
That's the main one that I wanna do.
Yeah. In my argument, like, Riverdale doesn't exist without it. Fargo, the series, doesn't exist without, like, Dexter doesn't exist without Twin Peaks. Like, it creates a whole thing.
It's amazing. TV. And the nice thing about Twin Peaks, although, I mean, there's violence and intense stuff in his other stuff, because it's on TV.
It's ABC, yeah.
Yeah, it was network television. People forget that it was network television.
Yeah.
It doesn't, although it's creepy, it doesn't get as disturbing as some of his movies do.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No. But it's all production design. The production design of Twin Peaks is fucking insane.
So great.
And it's a soap opera. It's set up to be, it's overacted. It's over. Everything's really dramatic. The music's really dramatic. But it sets up this whole genre of shit that we start doing from then. Anyway, okay. I don't know why we're still talking about that. I love you guys.
Yeah.
We should do the things that we do when we're done. And I'm forgetting what the first one is.
I have an LA spotlight if we want to talk that.
Yeah. Let's do it.
LA Spotlight.
I've got the recent show that Casa 0101 is doing, The Queen of Rumba. Ooh. Inspired by the true story of Alicia Parla, a Cuban-American woman who introduced the U.S. to rumba dancing. Cool. It's going through the 22nd of October, and you can find tickets on casa0101.org.
Yep.
I'll shout out Life Sucks at the Broadwater Interact Theater Company. It is getting great reviews, including one today from Terry Morgan that called it one of the best productions in town.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to go see it. Wow. In a couple
it's got
weeks.
One more weekend?
Or no, two? It's going through the end of October. So.
Oh, nice. Great. Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's all get there.
Yeah, let's
they
do
got
it.
Quite
yeah,
well,
it's Posner. It's Aaron Posner. It's the guy who wrote Stupid Fucking Bird.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I want to see
it's a riff on Uncle Vanya.
Vanya, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this episode, then you might have, then you may or may not have seen Mothers of God, the staged reading workshop that we did at Sacred Fools of a play that I wrote with my partner, Rachel. And it is, it went well. We won't know. We don't know yet, but I'm going to say it. I'm going to say it went well.
Rehearsals are going well at this point.
Yes, at the time of this recording, rehearsals have gone well. By the time you're hearing this, the show will have gone well.
Yeah.
Keep your eyes out, though, for Mothers of God. Maybe we'll get a production sometime in the future. But we love you guys. We appreciate you listening. Thank you for joining us for part one of one. No, one of ten of our David Lynch miniseries. No. No, thanks for joining us for our Scott's pick of The Elephant Man.
Yes.
And we'll see you next week for Season 2, Episodes 6 and 7 of Pin 15. If you don't know why, go watch them and you'll find out.
Yes.
You won't be sorry.
They're a blast. I actually watched them two nights ago. It's super fun.
It's super
So, that's...
and then
CJ.
After that is our winner. Is our fringe winner.
After that is... Which, by the way, I have two of his plays that we can read.
Great. Can't wait to read them.
And then we'll discuss Inferno, the winner. But we are going to do a super two-episode miniseries with our winner of this year's Fringe Playwright Award, the Theater Playwright Award, Roddy Viegas, who wrote the play Inferno, which was a take on Dante's Inferno. But we'll tell you a lot more about that later. It's going to be a blast.
Do y'all have questions or comments? Do you want to yell at me for being mean about Montana in the beginning of this episode?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Montana. I love you. You can reach out to us via email, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Our theme song is better than your theme song.
True.
He also writes all of our stingers. He's an amazing human being. And then finally, to the great award-winning playwright Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes and doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer.
We sure will. We love you, Carol.
What was the James McClure voice you came up with?
Oh, I don't remember.
Thank you. James McClure talks about like this. He's from Texas, buddies. His teeth, front two teeth are falling out, so he's got a bit of a whistle.
I don't know. I just make that up. All right, we appreciate you. Subscribe, rate, review. It really does help. We'll see you guys later.
I feel pretty.
Oh, so pretty. I feel pretty and witty and gay, and I pity any girl who isn't me today.
The theater, the theater.
Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater.